When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And welcome to The Great Indoors,
the podcast which reveals everything you ever needed to know about your interiors and explains how to make it all really work for you in your home.
I'm Sophie Robinson.
And I'm Kate Watson-Smythe. And today we are in my house, which is very exciting and means I don't have to wear a duvet on my head.
Oh, I love the fact that in the script it says jolly. You wouldn't say that word, would you? So good. Exciting, Kate. Well, I'm going to say it's jolly. I am jollied out to be in your house. It is so nice to be here. Sorry, I'm throwing you off. That just made me laugh. Jolly. There'll be no jolliness around here. Thank you very much.
I don't do jolly.
Okay, so listen, what I really wanted to say is here we are. Somewhat giggling at the end of another series, and hasn't it just flown by? I mean, the number of listeners who tune into this, quite frankly, hilarious podcast has really peaked recently, and this can only be because more and more people are discovering the thrill of designing a home and making it one you love.
And it goes without saying that we are both honoured to be spearheading the nation's newfound love affair with interiors. Our sponsor, Harlequin, are also at the forefront of the interior design revolution and soon are launching a new online tool to help you crack your personal colour code.
They are calling it Own the Room, and it comprises of a series of detailed questions tailored to discover your interior design personality, which will ultimately lead you to one of four distinct looks. Discovering the one which will be perfect for you is all part of the fun, because Harlequin know that making your home your own is the heart of great interior design.
And actually, I love the way you end up with not just a look, but a bespoke colour palette that's based around your answers. You can use this palette then to work up colour schemes for any room in your house.
And for me, the bit I really love is the Harlequin Colour Code, which also teaches you about some of the psychology and meaning behind the colours that have been selected for you too. So ultimately, your colour schemes don't just look good, but feel perfect too.
Come on then, come on. Question one, holiday destinations. Are you bustling streets and city lights, local markets and culture, spa time or lakeside retreat?
You can't make me choose. I've not been on holiday for months. I want to go to all those places. Can I just have all of them? What about this question? So is your wardrobe sleek, statement, monochrome, boho, delicate or bold?
Well, currently it's a bit of a mess. I've not had time to tidy up and I've barely got dressed for a year, but they are good questions. If you want to take the quiz, keep your eyes peeled on Harlequin's Instagram or head over to the Harlequin website on July the 1st when the Own the Room tool launches. And we'll also put a link in the show notes for you too. I'm going to do it as soon as it launches. But for now, we have to get on with the show.
Now, today, for your listening pleasure, we have a fascinating interview with Stephen Westland, who is, get this, a professor of colour science and technology. He'll be revealing the surprising science behind our relationship with colour. Plus, I've unearthed this brilliant video on YouTube, which tells you 10 things every stylish person has in their home. So we'll finally be able to find out once and for all, listeners, whether Kate is indeed a stylish person, because I'm here in her house and I'm going to see if she's got the evidence.
And I should point out that I have not seen this video. I'm a bit nervous. But first, before we come to my ultimate proof of total stylishness or complete humiliation, shall we begin with Halston? For those of you who don't know, this is the smash hit Netflix series inspired by the life of 1970s designer Roy Halston, who's played by Ewan McGregor. It's stylish, it's very saucy, but of course here at The Great Indoors, we are just as interested in the furniture as the frocks and well, the frolicking.
And I love the fact that even halfway through, I was jumping on a call to you going, are you watching this? The interiors are amazing.
I mean, it's everything come together. We've been talking for a while, haven't we, on here, on blogs, on magazines, about the return of the 70s. And obviously, this show is set in the 70s, kicking through into the early 80s. So it's all those design features we've been talking about writ large against the backdrop of fashion. So there's sort of hippie caftans and then going through the 70s. It's just, it's so visually stunning.
Yeah, like a lot of these incredible Netflix series, it's filmic, isn't it? And yeah. I think for me as well, the attention to detail, of course, because it's about a fashion designer. But I think what was so amazing and inspiration about Halston, and maybe why he was so incredibly pivotal at the time, is it was lifestyle. You know, it was everything. It wasn't just about the dresses. It was the people he hung out with. It was about Studio 54. Like you say, it just really captured a moment in time of high glamour, fast living, and utter fabulousness.
Well, they start at the beginning where he moves into his first studio, which is probably more my kind of look there, which I think Vogue or someone has called Haute DIY. I am here for that. I am here for Haute DIY.
What's Haute DIY?
Well, it's Haute Couture is high fashion.
Oh, I was not your porridge oats.
No. It's an H. H-A-U-T-E.
Haute
DIY, which is where he had his first fashion show. And there were brick walls and they wanted to sort of dress it a bit. So they rushed off and he didn't have any money. So they bought a whole load of kind of tie-dye material and tented the walls with it. Mm. And then he showed all these caftans. So it was a sort of tented hippie look.
Was really directional, wasn't he, in that whole kind of particular style? It was something new. It was moving away from quite a prim, geometric, stiff 60s vibe. Which, you know, that you think of the Mary Quant monochrome into this very louche 70s,
well, and
showing his snaky hips.
He had, this is not giving away a plot line, a sort of matter of background. I didn't realise this until I started watching it. He started out as a milliner and he made the very famous pillbox hat that Jackie Kennedy wore to the presidential inauguration. And then, of course, so that was in the late 50s. I'm struggling on my timelines here.
You're into
early
60s.
And then women stopped wearing hats. So, you know, he had to reinvent himself. And I take that as a great sort of inspirational thing as well. You know, sometimes your career is going in one direction and for whatever reason it changes. He reinvented himself, moved from hats to clothes, and off he went. And he was very controlling.
Well, he had a vision. He was a visionary, but he obviously had this flair and I think sensuality, what I really got from watching the show was he was really tuned in to feminine sensuality. And, you know, obviously as a fashion designer and a gay man, he, you know, it was all about the ultra suede. He wanted women to not just look fabulous, but feel fabulous. So the feel of the fabric was just as important as the cut and the look. And then I think that's also then played out his interiors. I mean, I absolutely adore the fact that, you know, we've got this kind of sleek minimalism going on by the time it's the late 70s, early 80s. And so quite uncluttered interiors, very high impact, but then these like huge oversized orchids. And there's this great quote from the film where his accountant is pulling him up on the amount of money he spends a year on orchids. And he says, orchids are part of my process and you can't put a price on inspiration. I thought, I'm going to use that. For me, it's not orchids, but
no,
I can work out something else to justify why I need to spend my budget on my interiors.
I was looking up that mid-century townhouse, which apparently, wouldn't you know it, has now been bought by Tom Ford, the designer who's restoring
it. Back in 2019.
And apparently in this flat, he used to serve his guests, including, of course, his best friend, Liza Minnelli, caviar, baked potatoes and cocaine. What I thought was interesting about that townhouse, though, and you mentioned it, and I was surprised you'd mentioned it, because it was very grey and minimal, and he had sort of grey jersey flannel sofas, and he had this grey industrial carpet in this sunken living room. And I was looking at that, and apparently his theory behind that was if you have a very sort of plain grey background, it makes the people in the room stand out and look amazing. And obviously I've written a lot about grey, I've used grey a lot, and I've always said that grey is a great backdrop to works of art, you know, pictures on the wall makes books stand out. And that for me has always been a fairly obvious way to use grey as a colour, but I would never have thought of using it as background for people.
And fabulous people in fabulous Halston outfits.
Really interesting.
I mean, you do have to have fabulous guests. I know it doesn't work for everybody. I mean, he got Andy Warhol, Bianca Jagger and Liza Minnelli hanging around at his house. They probably did decorate the space.
Somewhat more. Yeah, somewhat more than Auntie Maud might, yes. And obviously Enid the cat would completely disappear. But so that's the kind of minimalist town look. But he also had, which I think a lot of us will be more drawn to, this fabulous beach hut, which I think is more, it's not rustic, is it? Because it's not rustic in the sense that we would term rustic, no, but it had kind of white canvas sofas. And also, really interesting, it was more tonal, it was calmer, it suited its surroundings, more relaxed by the sea. But the thing I noticed was that all the books were reversed. Yes. I did notice that. And I thought, hang on a minute.
And apparently he was quite directional in that. That was his
idea.
So all these, there we are. Yes. All these Instagrammers.
Who didn't know what they were doing necessarily. But turns out they'd been influenced by Halston, who found it quite stressful to have all the different colours of the spines facing out. So he reversed them. So now we've all got permission to reverse our books. I've always been a bit sniffy about it. Now I think we've got permission because it's Halston.
I'm amazed that you're not apoplectic.
Does that make me one of your insanely stylish people?
You are so insanely swayed if someone's fabulous and cool. You're like, okay, I'll do that then. I mean, seriously, Kate, you have been banging on about what a design crime is. Not
totally, but now I think it's got design heritage.
So contrary. The interior for me that completely blew my socks off, I was going to say blew my skirt up. Maybe it did. I mean, I really loved it, was the Olympic Tower office. You know when he's really
the
made
red
it?
One.
Yeah, and it's that panoramic floor-to-ceiling glass view of Manhattan, and it's red carpet and red furniture and red lacquer gloss walls, and then obviously the enormous potted orchids. I just thought was absolutely insanely fabulous and very, very visionary.
Do you know how big that office was?
Was it massive?
12,000 square feet.
Ooh,
yeah. I mean, that's insanely large.
What I loved was that impact of that colour red, which just felt totally opulent, totally luxurious, really, really visionary because it was all about the colour. There wasn't any pattern. There wasn't, I mean, I just didn't really notice anything else in the room. Like the red sofa matched the red wall, which matched the red carpet. This really red monochromatic wraparound, saturated, lusty colour. It was so sexy and so exciting. And that's looking at it in 2021. Can you imagine what that would have felt like in the late 70s?
What I thought was interesting as well is in the beginning of the show when he's in his sort of white exposed brick wall first studio that he wears a lot of white. And by the time he's moved through into the red studio, he's got a red coat on.
I'm wondering whether this 70s sleek minimalism, but with this real saturated colour, we're going to see that influencing interiors. It certainly influenced you.
I have had a bit of a Halston moment, but I've been able to experiment because it's in the loft, which is the mad husband's office. So it's got an exposed brick wall, I suppose, which was painted. And we've had the look up there has been all sort of off-white, bit Halston's first studio, actually, off-white exposed brick walls. And we just came over a bit. Oh, let's go. And we were going to do it orange and then that didn't quite work. So we've gone for this kind of soft, pinky tomatoey red.
Well, you've gone for brick. It's a Farron Ball colour, isn't it? And it's got a bit of brown.
It's called Blazer.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Which was, I have to say, not a colour I was aware of on the Farron Ball.
It's the colour of my bath, isn't it? At home in the bathroom.
And that's really funny because I would have said it looked so much redder in your house than in my loft.
It does look redder in my house. Yeah. And it must be to do with the light and the space and everything else like that.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I love it. I mean, I love your home. It's so beautiful, but your colour palette is quite subdued and sophisticated.
I'll take that.
You know what I mean? All these I'm sitting here now in your library and it's chocolates and it's soft pinks and it's these worn Persian reds. And then you go into the loft conversion and you've got these sort of, and it feels quite New York loft actually. You've got black painted windows and white painted floor and there's the brick of the chimney breast, etc. There's beams. I'm loving the, but totally unexpected of you, Kate.
I'm still a bit scared of it, but I think I like it. But actually what I sort of wanted, if there was a process behind it, was that it is a sort of extension of the colours in the rest of the house, but just more. So there is, yes, there's pink down here, there's burgundy, there is, you know, Persian rugs are quite red. So it's actually just like taking those colours, which are in a more muted tone throughout the house, and then getting up to the top and going, bang!
Yeah.
That's the culmination of the colour palette right up there.
Yeah, it looks awesome. And then you've got your new Jonathan Adler Yellow Pop Neon Light on there, which is kind of like, it's quite Halston-esque.
Exactly. Going 70s vibe up there. I'm here for it.
I think it's really interesting because, okay, here's my confession. So everybody who knows my house, it's maximalist country chintz, maximum attack, isn't it? I'm finding, I don't know whether I can in my home, but I'm craving a bit of a low slung 70s sofa. I'm craving a bit of shag pile. I'm really digging it. And I think this is going to be interesting to see if this takes on as an interior trend, because everyone's talking about lockdown coming out and us going back to like the roaring 20s and all being a bit, but I think it might be the roaring 70s. That's what I'm more into. And I'm wondering whether my feeling of like, yeah, I want some party vibe, Halston-esque opulence too. Like, I want to wear...
You want to wear a keftan?
No. I like the halternet. It was all there.
I had a Halston top, actually. Not a vintage one, because I think the studio carries on. I had a very nice khaki green Halston top silk. I loved it. And then it came to an unfortunate end when I had a fight with some salad dressing. And that was the end of that.
Oh, I'm more into like the gold lame, halterneck, doing my spins on my mirrored dance floor, aka Studio 54. That's what I'm after.
So you're going to chuck out your chintz and go low slung leather, baby?
I'm just craving it. I just feel like, yeah, I'd love to. I don't think it's going to work in my house. Who knows, the extension coming in the autumn. Maybe we'll find room for a dance floor.
You make that point, though, about everybody talking about the 20s, because obviously the roaring 20s were 100 years ago. That style, to me, is quite formal and luxurious and hard edges, you know, that art deco. It was celebrating the sort of machine age, wasn't it? So it's not a soft and relaxing look. And we might have thought pre-pandemic that we were heading into a reworking of that look, whereas actually, as you say, maybe the pandemic means we've come out of that and we've gone forward to the more relaxed look of the 70s. So we want textures and corduroy and leather and low sofas.
I'm not talking about, I just want a party.
Oh, okay.
So do come and chat to us about TV-inspired interiors, from Mad Men bar carts to Breaking Bad meth labs, or perhaps not. We'd love to hear your stories, and you can find us on Instagram, where I'm Sophie Robinson Interiors, and she's Mad About the House.
Not forgetting the Great Indoors Podcast Facebook group, and a special mention this week to listener and Facebook group member Ruby Debs Oakley, who has been renovating a 1910 weatherboard villa in Christchurch in New Zealand. And she recently posted, "The house was 97% finished. The wallpaper was hung last week. Today, tragedy struck and the tumble dryer caught fire and my house is pretty much gone."
Oh, poor Ruby. Maybe facing a complete rebuild. It's really pretty grim. And all of us here at the podcast are sending all our love, all our sympathy and strength, Ruby, and really hope you end up with something, well, even more beautiful than before.
Echoing that completely. To take your mind off it all, and perhaps to inspire your next steps, have a listen to our interview with Professor Stephen Westland of Leeds University, who has written a white paper on colour for our sponsor Harlequin. His particular areas of expertise include colour science, machine learning, colour imaging, colour design, lighting, health and well-being. Now, I only actually know what about half of those really are, but essentially, Stephen seems to be interested in everything colour. Listen on to find out if you are a high screener or a low screener. And no, that is nothing to do with how much time you spend scrolling Instagram.
So welcome, Stephen Westland. And my first question has to be, what does a professor of colour do in a typical day? Can you give us an insight into what you're getting up to up there in Leeds?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And people think it's a really niche topic, a professor of colour science. But in fact, if you look around your room now, wherever you are, everything is coloured. I can see books in the particular I'm looking at, but walls, carpets, cosmetics, hair, skin, teeth, and of course our screens that we look at as well every day. And it turns out that all the people who make those things are really concerned about how to make them the right colour and what the colours mean. So in fact, most companies who make anything actually employ some sort of colour scientist somewhere in the company. And one of the things I do like about my job is that every day I could be approached by someone to talk about the colour of Weetabix or teeth or skin or cosmetics. I literally never know what's coming next.
Well, I think it's absolutely fascinating for us as interior design nerds and all our listeners. You know, colour plays such a big part of our interior design and our home environments. But I'm wondering what it was like for you to work with a brand who makes wallpaper and furnishings and fabrics, but wanted you to find out for them how they can service their customers, I suppose, on a deeper, more emotional level. What's interesting about this white paper is it's digging a little bit deeper beyond the surface look of colour, isn't it?
Yeah, so that was an example of where someone comes along, you're not expecting it, and it's something different and new. And it was a great fit because one of the things I'm really trying to do in my research is to try to find out what's true and what isn't true about all the crazy things you hear on the internet about whether this colour does that or this colour makes time pass more slowly or this colour makes your heart beat faster. You can read all sorts of stuff. The problem is some of those things are not true, but some of them, incredibly, are true.
Can you give us a couple of examples of colour myths you've busted? I mean, I hadn't even heard of the notion that people think certain colours make time pass faster or more slowly.
They also say yellow makes babies cry more. There's all sorts of these things, and people state them as facts. So one of the interesting ones is whether red makes the heart beat faster. So you can go on the internet and look for this, and you'll find it as fact. And in fact, when I tried to study it a few years ago, I actually had another academic saying to me, why are you doing that? Everybody knows that's true. But if you look at it, there's a PhD thesis in 1950 in California, which I can't get hold of, which seems to have some evidence. Now, I've actually done a lot of research on this, and there is a little bit of evidence that it might make your heart beat faster. But it's not going to go from sort of 60 beats per minute to 70. It might go from 60 to 60.3. You'd hardly notice it. And it's really not clear whether it does or not. But that's an example of something which people take for granted as if it's a total fact.
Well, and there's that other one, isn't there, about red, where it's very often used in dining rooms and it's supposed to be the colour of appetite. And I looked into this once.
I think you'll find that's orange.
Well, it turned out to be orange, but what people were saying was that red is associated with dining rooms and appetite, and Chinese restaurants are red, and that's why they paint them red, because they want you to eat more. Whereas actually, if you follow it through a bit further, for the Chinese, red is associated with luck and money. So they're actually painting their restaurants red because you go in there and you're going to spend lots of money, and orange is the colour of appetite. So you can sort of bend it to whatever you want, perhaps.
Yes, I agree. And there have been quite a few studies actually about people giving people peanuts on different coloured plates and trying to work out which ones people eat more peanuts from. But the results are often quite inconclusive. Because the effects of colour are so complicated and have multiple mechanisms, you can get slightly different results by just changing the conditions slightly.
I'm really interested to know more about this, because this is kind of quite a core part of the white paper, is the two sort of main arguments, and this is used a lot in interior design, that cool colours, especially blue, are calming and restful, and the warm spectrum, your oranges, yellows and reds, are uplifting, invigorating, they make you more alert, more excitable. And your research has sort of not always dispelled them as myths, but said it's a lot more complex than that. And it's not just about the colour, it's also about the quality of the light.
It's generally accepted that if you have a red environment, it's sort of stimulating, and blue is calming. It's true. But you can also read research that says that if we look at too much blue light, for example, late at night, which happens when we use our smartphones, for example, it actually stops us going to sleep. It has an alerting property. We may think we're sleeping well, but in fact it can disrupt our sort of deep sleep. So therefore you've got a real conundrum, because on the one hand you've got people saying that blue is calming, and on the other hand you've got people saying that blue is the opposite. It's actually stimulating. And how do you reconcile those two different findings? My argument is to understand that there are multiple what I call mechanisms. One of the mechanisms, you might refer to it as more of a psychological or emotional aspect. So the idea that blue is calming might be associated with the fact that people, when they think of blue, they think of blue skies and blue seas, whereas with red, they think of maybe something hot and fiery. maybe even angry. But there's another way in which colour can affect us. And I want to get slightly technical here, which is to say that we all know that our eyes respond to light, which is how we see. And when we see colour, they send signals to the back of the brain. That's where our vision takes place. But actually, those senses in the eye, they also send signals to a different part of the brain, which is right in the middle. And that part of the brain does things like regulating our temperature, maybe even regulating our sleep patterns, controlling the secretion of hormones. So, for example, when you wake up, your body starts secreting cortisol. And then later in the day, it stops producing that. Now, all of that process to do with your well-being is controlled to some extent by the patterns of light that we have. And those cells in the eye send their signals to the middle of the brain and are doing something quite different to those sort of emotional or psychological mechanisms. In the white paper, I think I refer to them as physiological effects. So the blue light effectively there is stimulating you. So then you've got these two almost contradictory effects of colour. And which one occurs? Well, they could occur at the same time in principle. But, you know, if you're in a room, for example, and your walls are painted blue, a bedroom, almost certainly the main dominant effect there is going to be the emotional or psychological one. So is blue a good colour for bedrooms? Absolutely it is. If you're looking at a really bright sort of blue light on the screen or looking at your computer screen, which emits quite a lot of blue light, because of its intensity, that's probably sufficient to activate this other mechanism. That's the main thing in my paper is about those two processes, isn't it?
So I'm already trying to think, you know, as an interior designer here, I'm already trying to think of a solution. Would it be that you could create a room with soft colour? And I think in the white paper, you talk about paint having a much more subtle effect on us than light. It's a much more, has a more intense effect on us than an ambient paint colour in the background. So I'm thinking maybe if your preference is for a blue bedroom, maybe then you have one of these lovely, sleepy, honey-coloured bedside lights that emit an orangey, warm, amber glow. So you've got the cool bedroom that's calming. It's reminding you of the sky and the sea. And then you've got your warm light, which is going to help you.
And that would be beautiful in terms of also the aesthetics, because you'd have the blue and the orange together, which is a lovely harmony, isn't it? So that would be, I think that sounds like a great design.
You said in your white paper that one study explored the effect of three rooms, one with warm coloured walls and furniture, one with cool coloured walls and furniture, and one with achromatic walls and furniture to see how people reacted to the different atmosphere. So I think that's what Sophie's sort of talking about there, doing the walls in one colour and using the lighting to play with the warm effect, because it says that when it's a sort of white light, which I'm assuming is a cool light, people worked better in short-term memory and problem-solving tasks.
I mean, if you think about how we've evolved to have loads of light in the day. And before we all worked indoors, we all worked outside. We had loads of light in the day. And then in the night, we had very little light. And if we had light at all, it was candles or firelight. And that's very reddish. So what's good for our bodies is to have loads of light in the morning, loads of blue light, that sort of wakes us up. And as the day goes on, you should be getting less and less intense light and warmer light. So having sort of warm lights in your house in the evening is a really good idea.
I love the fact that light has a colour quality to it, because I don't think that's thought about enough.
One other thing in your white paper, which I thought was really interesting, is a body of work for the last 30 years has been looking at people who are characterised as high screeners and low screeners. And when I read that, I thought, oh, well, I'm obviously a high screener. I spend all my day on my phone. But it's not that, is it?
No, so I've had a PhD student who's been looking at this topic. She's just finished her PhD. So this is one of the reasons why, when I said colour effects are complex and there are these two mechanisms, there are also different types of people. Some people are much more sensitive to their environment, and those people are low screeners. And the people who are less sensitive, they're high screeners, so they can screen out their environment. They remain relatively unaffected. I think I must be a high screener, because my desk at work, when I do go there, is horrifically messy.
I can't, if the colour's not right, I can't do it.
Yeah, so that would make you a low screener.
I think my husband must be a high screener, because he puts up with a lot in my house, doesn't he?
It's a generalisation, but designers tend to be low screeners. Designers tend to be quite sensitive to their environment, actually, and seem to particularly want to control it, and other people let it go.
That's fascinating.
But moving back to the decoration, I'm back to my paint colours. What was that other bit, Kate? Something about the chromatic room being the least popular. This is a bit I jumped on, Stephen, because I'm a real colour lover. And one thing that was jumping out for me was the chromatic rooms, or indeed white or neutral rooms, were not having a positive effect on people.
Colour can enhance performance and colour can affect creativity, whereas white walls were found to be boring and uninteresting.
And I didn't pay you to say that, Stephen, just for the record.
No, not at all. In fact, I've been saying this for a decade, actually. You know, I mean, years ago, there was a big push in hospitals to put artwork in hospitals. Because if you looked at lots of our sort of office buildings and things like hospitals, they have just really bland environments. And I don't think that's healthy for us. And I think colour isn't just fun and fantastic. It's also important. And it's important for our well-being and health.
Can you give us a little bit more fact, if you like, on how have you come to that conclusion?
We do have a special room at Leeds, actually, where we can change the colour of the lighting, not just sort of red, green, blue, but literally wavelength by wavelength. And we do things like we measure heart rate, we measure people's emotional well-being, psychological well-being, we measure their brain responses in order to come to these conclusions. I'll give you one project we're working on to look at colour in a really inhospitable environment, not a home, but maybe, let's say, a spaceship. Imagine you're going to put someone in a spaceship and they're going to stay in that spaceship a year. What can you do with colour to make it more bearable for them? And people might say, well, you should make it blue, or you should make it red, or you should make it green. But my argument is the biggest thing you could do is give people a choice. And especially if they can change it, actually, during their voyage. Because a lot of people like blue, for example. Many, many studies of colour preference have been done over the last 100 years, and by far, people's most favourite colour is blue. But I hate blue. I love pink and yellow and red, but I'm slightly anomalous. Most people like blue. So my argument is it's not about saying this colour does this or this colour does that, but people should buy the colours that they themselves like, that give happy memories to them, because we like the colours that remind us of things that we like. But there could be people, because of their previous life experience or how they were brought up, their associations are slightly different.
I'm with you on blue, actually. There's no blue in my house. And while you were talking about the sea and the sky, I was sort of thinking, oh, why don't I like blue? And you know what? I'm a really bad swimmer. And I hate putting my face under the shower. I really don't like water. And the other point I just wanted to make, you say you're doing this research, let's take an environment like a spaceship and put someone in it for a year and look at the decor. Well, we've all just been in our houses for a year.
We've been in our own spaceships.
We've all been in our own spaceships. And I think that's where this interest in colour and how we react to it is now reaching out to the wider population, because we're all more aware. And I'm interested in a line in your white paper which says that people at transitional or stressful times of their life may wish to temporarily create extreme environments. And regular listeners to the podcast will know that all through the lockdown, I kept talking to Sophie about how I wanted to paint my kitchen yellow. I hate yellow. I hate yellow almost as much as I hate blue. But where was this yellow coming from? And as soon as the lockdown ended, I was like, yellow? What yellow? I don't want yellow.
Maybe it was because you wanted to exercise control over this environment. I think that's a plausible reason for why you might want to do that. And I don't have the facts for this, actually, but I do work with quite a few paint companies. And my understanding is that paint companies are one of the sectors that have done quite well during COVID, because sales of paint have been quite buoyant.
And the other feedback we've had from paint companies Green. Is that bright colours, brighter, bolder colours have been way more popular in the last year. One of the things we've learned from this experience would be that colour is joy. And maybe people have really understood that, because, you know, grey has been a really fashionable interior design colour for, it's had a hold, hasn't it, for the last decade. And now they're saying that it's, you know, these warmer neutrals are coming in. But actually, I think what the paint companies have discovered is actually people want to be more experimental. And actually singing from your hymn sheet, I think, a bit, Steve. And I think people have thought, well, no one's coming around my house. It's just me in here. I'm just going to play around with colour and do what I like.
No, that's a very good point, actually, because I think in the white paper, I made the point that some people don't want to paint their rooms in really bright colours because they're worried about the resale and all of this sort of stuff because they might paint it a colour people don't like. But there's also the notion, which you've just touched upon, that people might be judged. So if you have an extreme use of colour in your room, other people may look at it and say, well, I wouldn't have done that. So people tend to be very conservative, don't they? But maybe in lockdown, they've basically gone crazy because no one's coming around anyway. They can do what they want. What I hope is that once lockdown is finished, people carry on using colour in this way and realise that it's okay to paint your room all these crazy colours. You know, it's fun to do it because, frankly, if you asked a child what colour that should be painted, they would paint it bright yellows and pinks. And we've lost that. As you get older, you lose that. Maybe we want to be sophisticated and that should be black or white or grey. But I would say it's much more important to have fun.
On that notion of fun, Professor, I don't want to give all your secrets away, but there you are sitting on a red chair by some very white walls. Just talk us through that after all your experimental having fun.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I will reveal that I'm actually married and my wife, despite the fact I repeatedly tell her that I'm a professor of colour science and I actually work in a school of design and I teach colour design. It turns out in this house, my opinions are worth very little. actually, it's a colour called elephant's breath. You've probably heard of it.
Yes, we have.
It's quite a famous paint colour, which I really don't like very much. But you can't see it. In fact, I've just turned my thing around slightly so you can see it. I know listeners can't see it, but you can see that I do have one wall which is bright red. What you might not have noticed is on the wall there's a picture, and in that picture it's a picture of Old Trafford, Manchester United. So I'm a massive Manchester United fan. I love red. The two things are connected again. And so I'm allowed to have my one red wall.
Yeah, so it's in your sight, isn't it? You've got your happy colour.
Exactly.
I think that's a really nice tip because one question I wanted to ask you was, with all this insight into the fact that we need to find our own happy colours, we can't just be prescribed the latest trends and tastes and you must do this and greys in and greys out, etc., etc. If we're ignoring all of that and we've got to work out, are we blue, are we pink, are we warm, are we cool? And then there's all the different tones of colours as well, of course. There's a lot of work for people to do. What you're kind of saying is, for you, you know, it's your favourite football team. Red, red's your happy colour. Like, just, you can find your colour joy and inspiration perhaps in some of the least obvious ways.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, you don't have to paint the whole room that colour.
I think you'll find you do.
The issue of the feature wall is a whole different episode. We'll bring you back another time. Thank you so much.
No worries.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Just loved that chat. So a huge thanks to Stephen Westland, and do have a read of his white paper over on the Harlequin website, which is harlequin.sandersondesigngroup.com. So to end the series, I thought we'd have a little bit of fun. I found this, what I think is quite a brilliant video on YouTube from houseofvalentina.com. This particular video has had 90,000 views and it is titled Home Items Stylish People Always Have in Their Home. And I cannot wait to get your views.
Okay, I'm slightly under pressure now.
Should we just crack on and rattle through it?
Go on then.
Okay, so the lovely Valentina and Jack, who are, well, they're a couple. They live in America. I mean, that's the other thing I think we should flag up. I think there might be some cultural differences here that we could explore.
Right.
But buckle up, Kate Watson-Smythe, because I'm here in your home and I'm going to find out quite how stylish you really are.
Oh, God.
So number one.
Yes.
Is, in inverted commas, cute soap pumps. Every stylish people's home has a cute soap pump.
Well, I've failed.
So you have to, if you're buying liquid soap in a pre-bought, you know, shop-bought bottle,
yes,
you can't leave it in there. You need to decant it into a stylish soap pump.
Where shall I start? First of all, I'm going to start with the fact that I'm now all over the soap bar. So it's all about the stylish soap dish. Obviously, I've got masses of them. But secondly, if I was buying soap in a pump, then I got to say I'd probably buy it for the container. Therefore, I wouldn't need to decant it.
Oh, see, you're one step ahead.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One step ahead.
Right, does that make me insanely stylish?
Let's
one
find out.
One for me or one for Valentina?
I'd say that's one to Kate WS.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, next one. Beautiful baskets. And she recommends we buy a basket and stuff it with our stuff. Baskets. Everyday items become more chic when they're put in a basket. I'm looking around.
No, you won't see one.
Oh, no, there's a log basket next to your fire.
I've got a basket in my office, which I use as a waste paper basket. I'm making my rubbish more stylish with every toss of crumpled paper that goes in there. This is not a house of basket, but I'm not saying they're not stylish.
Well, she says you can even put books in a basket.
No, what? No, you can't.
I knew that.
Books go on a shelf or on a table, even a pile on the floor to double up as a table. I've done that. We're not putting books in a basket.
Well, Jack and Valentina go so far to say that when people visit their home, they don't even realise they have children because there are no toys on views because all the toys are in the baskets.
Ooh, I tell you who would have issues with that is our friend of this podcast and interior design master's presenter, Michelle Agundahin. She feels very strongly that, you know, children have to be part of every home.
Oh,
if they are part of a home, then don't hide them away. She's quite anti-playroom, I think, because she feels that children should be, you know, allowed to own the space. So,
right.
So in summary on that, I'm not anti-basket. I'm anti-books in a basket.
Anti-books and potentially anti-toys in baskets. Well, I'd say that's a very sensible retort.
Oh, I am.
So we call that a draw. We'll call that a draw. Mm-hmm. Okay, next one. Blankets.
Are you pointing at me? She's pointing at me with a pen.
Because blankets in baskets. And you get a double win. You get double points if you've got blankets and you put your blankets in the baskets. You've got a blanket. I'm here and you have a blanket neatly folded, resting on the side of your sofa. That's what they're talking about. That's what stylish people have.
Stylish blankets. Okay. That's there because
fashionably
I can't,
folded.
Can't quite be bothered to take it upstairs. And also I think my 20-year-old son uses it when he's down here late night watching TV when the heating's gone off. So maybe that makes him insanely stylish.
Okay, next one. Pretty doormats. Now, this apparently, according to Jack and Valentina, is extremely important because it's all about first impressions. And one's doormat must be, and I quote, super stylish and super cute. And Jack goes so far to say that he loves doormats so much, he wished he had more front doors.
Of course, the first thing you see when you come into someone's house is the hallway. The hallway is a very underrated space when it comes to decor.
So we're on board with that.
Because we're not coming in looking at our feet, are we?
No, but
it's not the first thing we look at. We're looking straight ahead to the pictures,
well,
to the decor.
You're clearly not wiping your feet before you visit.
Is this where you
homes?
Have a doormat with typography in as well, which says come the F in or F out?
Jack and Valentina quite like a monogrammed doormat with their initials on.
What, just in case they forget who they are?
You're being mean now. So I'm going to move you on to where I already know where this is going.
Oh,
candles. And hold your breath. Jack and Valentina say it's not just a candle. Obviously, it's a scented candle. And not only is it a scented candle, it is a lit candle. They say stylish people always have a candle going, always have it lit. This adds warmth and fragrance. And they understand that stylish people know that a home also has to feel stylish. So there we go. Jack actually buys candles nonstop and he has candle drawers to put all his collection of candles in.
I feel I need a word with Jack. I've had a bit of a conversion on the candle.
I have come round to the idea
of a scented candle in a limited capacity.
Right.
But I'm not sure we have them burning all the time, do we? I like, in summer, having the door open and smelling. I was in the garden hanging my washing out the other day. It's a very picture of domestication it is around here, you know. And all I could smell was the lilac from next door's garden.
Oh, I thought you were going to say and the lovely waft of persil coming in through the double doors.
No, it was actually real life flowers. So I don't know. I'm in candles. I don't know you want to light them all the time.
I think you might like this, though. I thought this was interesting. They said people need a signature scent. Now, Valentina doesn't like the way that Jack lights a different scent in every room. She doesn't think that creates good flow. And she thinks you should just have one scent, your signature signature scent, and then the people you invite into your home will know you for your scent.
Well, that's quite interesting because I've worn the same perfume for 20 years, which is a Mademoiselle by Chanel. So I would always feel that there is, if you like, a scent of me, but I suppose I've never taken it through into the house.
Well,
but I think, you see, do I have issues with this? I have thoughts.
Yes,
I have
thoughts. Yeah.
Because I think houses have their own signature scents because of the people who live in them. And that's just something they're bringing to it. Well, are you trying to override it with your musky rose or whatever that you're lighting in every different room? Or it's all about the kind of essence of the people who live here. So I've said before, and we've spoken about candles, you know, for me, the smell of my grandmother is lavender and mothballs. That's a smell I love. Now, I don't suppose she set out to have her house smelling about mothballs, but, you know, it was quite a mothy house. So that's what happened. That's a kind of comforting smell that's not a contrived one. So, and also, people like different candles depending on the mood they're in. So I'm with Jack.
I'm with Jack.
I think if you want a different candle for different rooms or your different mood, I think that's all right. I think Valentina's got too many rules.
All I'm going to say is some of these scented candles are like 25 quid a pop. So to have them lit every day, I think might be a budgetary issue. Anyway, moving on.
Yes.
What do you think of this one? Every stylish person's home has coffee table books. It shows who they really are. And Jack thinks this is a very thoughtful thing to do. It gives your guests something to look at when they come and visit.
As we sit here in my library, surrounded by books.
I was going to say, we'd never get into conversation.
I clearly do not have an issue with books. What I have an issue with, and this is going to come back to the colour coordination of the books and possibly even the books with their reverse sides outwards, Halston. I have an issue, I think, with books being used as a tool like that.
A styling tool.
Yes. I think books tell stories. They're part of the personality. They're part of the scent of a house, the essence of a house. And so, I mean, obviously I've got loads of coffee table books.
There
I've got loads
books
of books
everywhere piled up on all the surfaces.
Yeah, I've
on
got
the,
coffee table books piled up as
well,
tables,
you've
their footstools.
You've even got so many books that it's actually making a side table with a lamp on it.
Yes, exactly. So I'm not sure I would use books as a styling tool.
Just even though you do. Quite. All right, moving on. You're going to love this one. This is my favourite. And I think this is a bit of an... this could be quite an American-British cultural thing, but let's see how it lands. Seasonal door wreaths. Shot intake of breath. So this goes along apparently with the doormat idea, and it's all as Valentina says, I love this, she goes, it's the welcome home package. It completes the welcome home package, your doormat and your door wreath. And they go as far to say that wreaths aren't just for Christmas, and wreaths are actually to celebrate the season. So Valentina says you have to do something extra gorgeous.
Oh, I'd like to know where Valentina lives.
There's no door wreath on the other madhouse greeting me. And I didn't even, actually, you're right, I didn't notice the doormat when I turned up. So there's 1 point to you. But there certainly wasn't a seasonal wreath.
I've never put a wreath on my door, and I feel like it's a bit of an Instagram thing.
It's got more popular. I think it is wafting over across the Atlantic.
Maybe
and
coming
into our,
here.
Into our Instagram feed.
Because there is now, isn't there? You see people doing Halloween wreaths and Christmas wreaths. And
no, Christmas wreaths has always been
a
thing.
A classic. But the Halloween wreath is new.
Is it? I did not know there was a Halloween wreath.
I've seen more of those. I wonder if there's now going to be seasonal wreaths. Not in this house, there won't be.
There won't be, will there?
Sure I mind it. If that's what you want to do, if you've got time to do all that, then knock yourself out. I'm not sure I've got time or feel the need to proclaim to anybody driving down the street that the stylish person lives here. You know, I mean, I live in London in quite an urban scenario. I would rather the front of my house looked a bit like Shameless with a battered down fridge in the front of it. It might deter the burglars.
Okay, well, I'm not going to be jumping on the seasonal door wreath thing either because I live in the middle of nowhere.
Nobody drives past my front door.
Right, okay, on to the next thing. Appropriate stemware. And stemware is glasses. So
why can't they just... I'm already cross.
No, I know
I'm already cross.
I know this is not going well. But listen, hold that thought. Why justify? Jack, this is Jack's idea. So this has come from Jack, this idea. And it all was triggered because they have some good friends who are diplomats. And when they go over there and they get offered drinks, all the drinks, depending on what the drink is, comes in a different type of glass.
Well.
harking back to the last episode.
I was just going to say, I have two thoughts on this.
Right.
One is, we go back to the last episode, which is about the tablescaping, as you called it,
and table the sense laying, of occasion, as I call it, and
the occasion and all that. And I, you know, I get that can be quite fun. I also recall having been to places where I felt quite stressed by the amount of glasses and cutlery and crockery on show. And I feel that that can be quite unwelcoming. And I think it's not necessarily stylish.
Intimidating.
Okay. And it can be almost a bit snobbish to say, you know, look at us, we put it in these fantastic glasses. And, you know, it's like I once went to a dinner party where there was a different glass for every different wine. And I'm sure that's the way you're properly supposed to do it. But it felt kind of scary and over the top. And actually, as a reaction, when we had them back here for dinner, we served them red wine out of little
tumblers. That's very French, isn't it?
It's a slightly passive aggressive act, but I find that more relaxing.
And one could argue just as stylish.
Just as stylish, yes.
Okay.
More comfortable.
Okay, so...
So here's my thing.
Right.
I think things that stylish people have in their homes is being able to offer a sense of welcome and comfort. That's what every stylish house should have, and it doesn't matter what it looks like.
So your nan's house is ultimately one of the stylish...
Yeah.
Most stylish
with
places
the mothballs
to be. Yeah. And the crochet tea cosy.
Yeah. This is the last in the current series, but do not fear. We will be back in 2 weeks with loads more tips, tricks, advice, and, well, arguing. And in the meantime, if you could leave us a review on the podcast app, that would be fabulous.
And for more details and everything we've covered in this episode, do check out the blogs. Mine is sophierobinson.co.uk and hers is madabouthehouse.com. But for now, enormous thanks to Harlequin, who have been our fabulous sponsors for this series. Giant thanks to our producers, Kate Taylor and Sarah Cudden of Feast Collective, and to Tom Brignall, who mixes each episode so beautifully. And the most vast thanks of all to you for listening.
And we'll see you in the great indoors.
Sorry, I'm breaking up. Just made me laugh.
I'm beginning to think I preferred it when I wasn't allowed anybody in my house either. And it's mayhem. She's also had two glasses of fizzy water, so she's going to start purping.